your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, May 15th, 2025, as we record this new episode. Severe weather coming through Chicago last night impacted our podcast plan significantly. Unfortunately, James got stuck in Cincinnati, and I had to deal with power issues. I hope for everyone listening in the Chicagoland area, you came away unscathed from Thursday night storm. Like we've always done with the Sox Machine Podcast, though, we press on. If the franchise ineptitude hasn't killed us off yet, we won't let Mother Nature do it. Side note, that's not a challenge, Mother Nature. Please don't drop a tornado on my house. In this episode, we recap the action down in Cincinnati as the Chicago White Sox, in a mild surprise, won the series against the Reds, even winning on Pete Rose Day. I'll share as far as the White Sox pitching and how that's helping the team have a pretty successful May so far. They're 7-7 this month. Who is stepping up offensively, yet concerning about who is stepping up and why they're stepping up? And the new faces that are joining the Chicago White Sox. And this weekend, weather permitting, is also the first of two series against the Chicago Cubs. We'll go over pitching probables and highlight the key matchups. Also, could we see more openers this weekend with Kyle Tucker looming in the first inning? And it would be a good time for Luis Robert Jr. to also go off. Joining me from Cincinnati is Sox Machine's beat reporter, James Fegan. And from the Alaska frontier, it's Jim Margulis. And hello, gents. James, the White Sox won a road series and even won on Pete Rose Day. And I think it's enlarged to the outstanding pitching performances from both Jonathan Cannon and Davis Martin. Is their stuff getting better, James, or is the Reds offense just that bad?
So, like, I think that any natural series reaction where the White Sox win, there's like a healthy dose of, it's good for them. They're, you know, playing as well as they can be, and also a little, boy, did that team have ambitions this year? Because I don't know. And I think there's certainly some of that was watching the Reds. They're banged up. There are people out. You know, they don't have, you know, Christian Ernacion Strand. Jaimer Candelario still working his way from it back. It doesn't look as complete as it's supposed to be. But it's also like a lot of guys struggling. Like Spencer Steer had a pretty good series, but started it like kind of in Andrew Vaughn territory. It's his numbers. Ellie De La Cruz, like, had a very good series, but definitely not having like a star, like breakout platform season. Is it a Matt McClain's been really cold? They're supposed to be excited about him being back as well. So yeah, I don't see it there for them. I don't think like they're, you know, secretly worse than the White Sox. I think this is like an accomplishment of, you know, outplaying superior talent offensively, but a little bit worried about them. Davis Martin, you know, we wrote a story about it. He very much clearly hasn't upgraded his stuff in the sense that, you saw him making progress towards it the last two times. I knew he'd been using a new slider grip from the Houston start, but this was the one where like it clicked that he was throwing 89-90 sliders and getting piling up whiffs with them. Only threw like 11 changeups all game. Only a left-hander basically used it like a fourth pitch. It was getting tagged as a cutter because it was so hard and so sharp, but it's getting slider level whiffs with it. And he clarified post-game like it wasn't a slider. This is something that they've been working on with. His slider was what carried him to the majors. Even then, it wasn't as good as it flashed the other night. I don't know if it's going to be how it looks every time. His velo was up across the board, and the slider obviously bore with that. But Davis did said that they kind of looked at some stuff with his mechanics after the Royal start and said, this is what it looks like biomechanically when you're, you know, sit in the highest of your fastball ranges. This is what it looks like low. Do that. I'm sure it's a little bit more complex, but it obviously worked. It's warm weather too. But I think the version of Davis Martin, which we've seen flashes of at times, it has been super consistent where he's 94, 97, you know, averaging 95, throwing a really hard slider off of it. And like the kick cane just can be like a, you know, complimentary feature pitch. Yeah, that guy could be pretty good. He's already been kind of defying his peripherals and being, you know, I think what we kind of expected of a kitchen sink righty with, hanging out in the high threes ERA wise, and his peripheral is a bit worse than that. I think if you said that at the start of the season, we'd all be like, oh man, that sounds like good Davis Martin. So if there's any tick up to that, that can make it a little bit more sustainable, that's good. Cannon, I don't like the stuff models do not like Cannon's change up. But it is something he's been saying is his best pitch, and he feels like he's been making a ton of progress on since spring. I think it's still for him a lot of the sinker action's been good. You see him throw middle sinkers, and they just get into the ground fairly often. It's more action wise and consistency than I think the velo popping. But I think he's more of a case of like, this is a dude who's been touted for his command, and if he's setting up his changeup well, which he has to do in very painstaking fashion, but has been capable of pulling it off, he's going to be able to have this level of success. It seems like he's out chasing his peripherals a little bit. He's your innings leader. He's your best ERA guy so far. I think we've seen Jonathan Cannon doing this, dating back to the last second half long enough to be like, this can kind of be his guy, even if I don't have the same little fun narrative of he tweaked a new pitch and now he's totally different. That seems to be more of a Davis Martin thing, overnight pitch changes, but maybe more people can get on the act. Shane Smith has obviously done his share of that as well so far.
Yeah, we'll get the chance to see Shane Smith on Friday against the Chicago Cubs. We'll preview his upcoming start later in the show. Jim, kind of zooming out here in the last eight games for the White Sox, six of those eight games on the run prevention side, they have allowed three runs or fewer. Now, that's a pretty impressive streak, and that's how a team that went 5-21 in April is already 7-7 in the month of May. That goes a long way. The White Sox now, starter wise, with the staff ERA, ranks 12th in Major League Baseball. They're at 3.78 for the season. Starter ERA, 3.78. That's very good. Are you getting more confidence in this starting rotation? Because I know we were really worried about the depth with all the injuries that are happening before the season, and there is still that concern about the depth. And maybe they are over their skis, but there are good results here, especially in the last eight games.
Yeah, I think the starting rotation, as we've seen it, Martin Perez and then Smith and Martin and Cannon and Wilson, is there now, and just kind of going through, Burke, among those options, they were the plan A, and they've been more or less fine, inconsistent, but major league arms providing major league production, whether it's first division production or number five production, they kind of vary between those, but like they're, for the time being, major league pitchers. I think my concern about the depth has always been like the Drew Thorpe, Kai Bush, Mason Adams tier being eliminated. And now you have like Jesse Schultens being promoted. Or, yeah, he's back on the rehab trail. He's been called up to Charlotte, according to his transactions page. And Mike Clevenger's there. And Justin Dunn, and Nastrini looks like he's in the bullpen now. So, like, who knows if anybody gets hurt? But I always thought I was like comfortable with the arms that they have, the major league rotation being major league arms. I was just hoping that there'd be a few number threes among them rather than like all fours and fives, which gets a little old. But like Cannon, like, he hasn't walked a guy all month. He's plunked a guy, but he's gone, three starts, six innings apiece, no walks. Martin, as James talked about, it looks like he's getting back to what his form was, along with what his form, was enhanced to where like that's kind of interesting. Burke is Burke in terms of like perhaps the most enticing stuff, but also the shakiest command of the bunch and whether that hangs around. But like they're all fine. And I think what's, I guess most encouraging about them is that, especially like a guy like Cannon, you look at his pitch percentage charts over the course of game to game, and it looks like two drunks playing a game of cat's cradle in terms of just like all the colors tangling amongst themselves and not being sure. Like if I were, say, a San Francisco Giants blogger, no reason to pay attention to the White Sox, and the Giants traded for Justin Cannon, be like, oh, what's this guy all about? I look at his pitch chart, like I have no idea what he throws. Like I, what does he lead with? What's his best pitch? Hell if I know. And we've seen that enough watching him up close to where like the cool thing is that he can kind of mix and match, and he doesn't like beat his head against the wall with the same way twice. Like sometimes he runs into his own limitations, but like he doesn't, he's able to shake the scouting report and then they catch up to again. And then like he shakes the scouting report. He's kind of like the Millennium Falcon, like not the fastest ship in the galaxy, but like knows what he's doing enough to, fool them and get away with it. So, when you mix, him riding the ship along with, Martin being interesting, Smith being really interesting, Burke being more interesting in terms of their stuff, and like that's fine. So I think like they're where they need to be individually. I think like the, Martin Perez, Bryce Wilson transition is going about as well or not well as you'd think, but, along with like say Will Venable going to the opener with Cannon, like having that trick in the bag helps them out a little bit too, to where there is more, variability and more flexibility with terms of like if they have weaknesses or they're going against the lineup that might crush them, a little bit of variability on the manager level in terms of how to help them out.
Well, offensively for the White Sox in this series, they got a big home run in the first game from Miguel Vargas as the White Sox took the lead 2-1 in the 10th inning. Really good at bats in that 10th inning. Matt Theis drew a tough walk. Chase Mydroth reminding me of Nicky Two Strikes Madrigal with the RBI single. Very next pitch, Vargas annihilated for a 3-run homer. That was a good moment for the White Sox. Lenine Sosa and Michael A. Taylor the following night both hit home runs. But the White Sox team OPS is still dead last in Major League Baseball. They're at 613. In the month of May, despite them being 7-7, the team OPS 611. And we talked about the concern of smoke and mirrors with the White Sox pitching. And when you look at, all right, yeah, Josh, that sucks. Who is performing well? And if you just look at OPS, there are three hitters in particular: Chase Mydroth, Edgar Caro, and Matt Theis. But when you break those OPSs down, Chase Mydroth, 350 on base percentage. That's good. 275 slugging percentage. Not good. Edgar Caro, 390 on base percentage, 338 slug. Matt Theis at 391 on base percentage, a 324 slug. Here's my concern, guys. And James, I'll start with you. At some point, opposing pitchers, if they fall behind Mydroth, Caro, and Theis, all three of these guys have a good understanding of what their strike zones are, and they're disciplined enough to wait out on pitches. But when counts get to 3-1 or 2-0, opposing pitchers are just going to start throwing fastballs down the middle, right? Just to challenge these guys.
Yeah, theoretically that would be great. So they'd probably get hits off of them, ideally. Theis, to start at the lowest leverage option, I guess. Theis has like intentionally shortened his swing path to be able to kind of follow the fight those off more than he did in past years. He's kind of always had high walk rates, even when he had a ton of whiffs. Like when, I think when any time I've like mentioned a swing adjustment to Theis, he's like, "Well, I've always drawn walks." And like almost like this is not something I have to like fight to do, which I always kind of admire when players are steadfast about what their strengths are. Yeah, theoretically, you'd think he'd be hard pressed to keep up like a 390 OBP, like what he's doing. All those guys, like their chase rates are like so low that even if they're not getting challenged pretty regularly, like I think they'll walk a decent amount just because like they're really top of the scale in terms of discipline. Caro, I think, while we would like Eric and I talked about how like the exit velocities were kind of like a tick below average, so it's hard to like project him to be like 15 to 20 home run power. What it does it look like in terms of production of the minors? It's not no power. It's been kind of a little weird how it's been this season, and he's kind of hinted at something being off by saying like his power is coming, and it definitely hasn't jumped on fastballs the way he has in the past, but like his right-hand swing is supposed to be more pop, like if he gets turned around, and especially if if the opportunities that Theis gets are going to be against righties, like theoretically there's going to be some opportunities for Caro to maybe drive the ball against lefties a bit more. But it's been a long characteristic for him. He's hit when he's been healthy and not been horrifically over-assigned by the Angels. Like He's been a 15 home run guy, and I would expect a little to show up for him, and he's certainly come a little bit close. My drop is the one to like, none of his swings have really looked like. It's not like to bring back the Millennium Falcon references. There's no point where he's like slamming on the hyperdrive and it's not responding. Like his trajectories are just all very low level, and I think that's kind
Can
of
I
the
just
question.
say I'm loving the Star Wars references in the show? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Specifically, Millennium Falcon. We're all just relating to the team
I
too.
have nothing past the episode one. That's where I hopped off and never returned.
A ship that's like very lacking in tools that they're trying to manage with, I think, is the easiest parallel with the White Sox. But yeah, I think Mydroff is going to be able to kind of continue to get on base. Is it more like 350? Because there's not he's not going to get pitched around like ever. Or is it can it be more? I think it needs more power to get toward the heights that he had in AAA, where threatening 400. I think that's obviously limiting if he can be challenged that way. But I think it's really an open question to see when the opportunities come up to see him really driving the ball, because obviously he's able to do that a little bit in AAA, but I think a lot of the swings we've seen have been him fighting stuff off to right field, which is a great skill and a great instinct that he has to do it. But I don't really necessarily have seen in these first couple of weeks where the power is going to come from for him, with how he's currently being pitched. And that might be concerns me more than kind of the immediate specter of like the OBP is going to go away, because he could not be chasing less. Like he's doing like he's wringing everything out. And I
Yeah.
think that gives him at least a good floor to get walks just from poor execution, even if the strategy is going to be the challenges, dude.
Well, he's always hurt.
There's that.
Like, I don't get how he, yeah, it's like I don't get how he's racking up this this like operation chart. Like, if you, I remember, I think it was Fox Sports site used to have like a human body with like various red zones of where a player has been hurt over the past 2 years. And like his look like chip beef right now in terms of just how many things are going wrong with him all over the place.
He said at the time once he came back from the IL that the thumb was not bothering him anymore and he didn't think it'd be an issue. It's a little bit of like a feel like a rookie trying to say like all's well, please keep playing me. But he did say he was probably going to wear the guard going forward. I could see him in Cincinnati; his shoulder was still taped up, and the ankle was the thing that was bothering him near the end of last homestand. That I think we've joked along the beat of like calling him like young aches and pains,
I like it.
but obviously it was a derisive name towards the original usage of saying that someone was kind of faking it or hamming it up, whereas it seems like Chase is very much someone, a rookie trying to establish himself with his first extended run of playing time that his original org was not willing to give him, kind of battling way through nagging injuries. So I don't want it to have the negative connotation, but he's certainly someone who's racking up like a lot of things he's playing through early on that ideally it goes well, but also maybe that's something, a good reminder of while we're not seeing him drive the ball of, maybe he doesn't have as much ability to lift up the ball right now with what he's dealing with shoulder wise and thumb wise.
Yeah, Mydrot's average exit velocity right now, according to Baseball Savant, is 86.5 miles per hour. Caro is almost 91 miles per hour. Neither have a barrel on the season, but the hard hit rate for Caro, which is exit velocity is greater than 95 miles per hour, is up to 46.6%. So I could see where maybe in the near future, Jim, we're going to watch more doubles. We're going to finally see home runs from Edgar Caro. But are you concerned? Is this a bit smoke and mirrors in the success that Mydroth, Caro, and Theis are finding? Because again, these are pretty huge gaps between on base percentage and slugging, something we typically don't see.
Yeah, I think part of it, I think there are like a whole lot of individual elements here. So I don't know if there's a unifying theme between the three. I think like Theis, he made swing changes, but he's also had a batting eye. Also, probably something in the scouting reports, whether it's remnants, whether it's team still learning, saying like he can drive a ball if you screw up. Like, he's somebody who had a couple triple-digit exit velocities against Cincinnati on Thursday, including a warning track flyout. Will Benson made a nice catch on it, so he can. He's had a history of doing damage. His college scouting report was a power guy, so I think he's probably somebody who's earned a little bit of caution for not just piping it in there. Whereas, Mydroth being somebody with a slower swing, and, Caro being a rookie who doesn't like wow you with his, how he's like grinding the bat in the batter's box. Just he's not somebody who's like just you see like the forearm muscles rippling, ready to rip one out of there. Like he seems like he has a pretty, I would say, maybe not passive approach, but more of a defensive approach, or comfortable getting two strikes. And then when he gets to two strikes, he's not going to try to do too much. He's going to try to, use his hit tool. And so he probably is costing himself some two strike exit velocity because he's looking more to poke the ball. So I think as the league gets used to him, like I thought with Caro, they might start busting him inside a little bit, and then you'll have to see the power, and more aggressive swing start coming around to actually get the barrel to it. But overall, I wonder if part of this is just watching, or part of our apprehension here is watching the White Sox with so many aggressive hitters, just not know what it looks like to regularly watch a guy who can take a walk and let the pitcher walk him, which like we've seen plenty with White Sox relievers, like how the hell could you walk this? And then, just it's a 5-pitch walk to a guy slugging 310 and then you turn the lineup over to Mookie Betts, whoever. And we've seen that plenty of times for White Sox relievers. And so maybe this is a case where the White Sox actually have some guys where if they're going to get a walk, they're going to take it. They're not going to say like, oh, let me hit my way on base. And so, that's a little bit alien as well. I imagine, there will be a league-wide adjustment to where Caro will have to punish the ball. And this tightrope that Mydroth is walking is one that all of the scouting evaluations have said, like, let's see if he can do it. But overall, I think it's a case of, oh, this is three guys with above average batting eyes to very good batting eyes. And how do they do this? How do they keep getting away with taking a pitch, 2 inches off the plate when Lenin Sosa or Andrew, Lenin Sosa would be swinging over it. Andrew Vaughn would be grounding it weekly, and getting no results.
Well, speaking of Andrew Vaughn, other positives, only two batters.
What? Oh, Andrew Vaughn.
I know. Ready? Get
you?
Ready for this. In the last 15 games of the month of May, Miguel Vargas leading the way for the White Sox with a 752 OPS. Andrew Vaughn, 712, because he's got two homers and five doubles in the month of May. In April, he only had two doubles and two home runs. So the slugging is fueling the OPS for Andrew Vaughn. He has only walked once in this month. He's hitting for power. There was an interesting quote from manager Will Venable in regards to comparing Andrew Vaughn and Tim Elko. Here is that quote pregame before Thursday between the White Sox and Reds from Will Venable.
You know, I don't know. There's, for me, obviously there's this narrative of like Elko versus Vaughn, which I understand, but that's just, it's not the case. And I don't know if he feels that or not. Like, I was transparent with him. When we were bringing Elko up to give him a heads up that it was happening, and it was not a Elko versus Vaughn thing. So, you'd have to ask him if that's a feeling that he has, but that's not, that's not how we look at it or how we view it.
We'll see how much playing time Tim Elko has this upcoming series against the Cubs. I'm still expecting Andrew Vaughn to be in the lineup, whether at first base or DH. But the White Sox are now 14-30 as they come back home to Chicago. They'll play at Wrigley first, but after that, next week, both of those series against the Seattle Mariners and the Texas Rangers are at home. So the White Sox have this nice little 10-day stretch where they are in Chicago. Next weekend, Sox Machine will be hosting a White Sox watch party at the Remova Loft inside the Remova Theater off 35th and Halstead on Saturday, May 17th at 1 p.m. Central Time. Watch the White Sox battle the Chicago Cubs on Remova's 20-foot video wall. We'll have baseball trivia going on between innings and baseball bingo throughout the game where you can win prizes. Remova now has a burger of the month, which this month's is a muffaletta burger. That sounds awesome. You can also check out the new beer options as well. The event is free and kids are welcome. So if you have problems getting CHSN to work on your antenna, or you don't even have the marquee channel, or you don't have the CHSN app, forget those stresses and come down to the Remova Loft for the Sox Machine Watch Party to watch the White Sox against the Cubs on Saturday, May 17th. Before we preview the White Sox and Cubs series, a couple of roster moves. One, the Chicago White Sox have traded for reliever Miguel Castro. Castro is 30 years old. He is tall. He is 6'7". He's made 419 appearances in Major League Baseball. Most of those came with Baltimore and Arizona. He's got a career 4.20 ERA. He got 11 save opportunities with Arizona back in 2023 and got 7 saves. And he's a 4-pitch mix, slider, 4-seam, 2-seam, and changeup. James, you alluded to this fact that the White Sox were going to be searching through the waiver wire or any means necessary to try to add relievers, try to find guys with velocity that could help out, especially in medium leverage situations. I'm assuming that's what they're hoping for with Miguel Castro. Is anyone hurt in the bullpen? Who is who's not going to be with the White Sox as they head back home to Chicago?
I don't know of any issues. Obviously, reliever issues, injury issues pop up, but you know they kind of the reason they didn't go with the opener on Thursday was that they felt they were too light on late inning relief depth. I think you could make an argument that it would have been better to try to survive or stay in it up front of that game rather than what they wound up doing. But the fact that they're feeling that pinch, shows a need. They're kind of a little bit, they're the rare opener using team where it's not like they lack for the lefties to throw out front. It's more that they feel like back-to-back games where they have, basically save situations that they feel burned out of all like their righties that they kind of use in, leverage situations. So Castro's has good numbers in AAA, but I'd have to see more of that to really feel great about him being added to that mix of, which is kind of really just Jordan Leisure, Stephen Wilson, and Cam Boozer right now, which handle like leverage, and Mike Vassell apparently. Though, as I have a notes piece going in the morning, it kind of explains why like bottom of the lineup, 3 out of 4 righties, why that kind of was the pocket for Vassell, even though it was the ninth. But they're obviously hurting for kind of anything leverage options. Castro pitched with the Diamondbacks when Barfield was there. He's kind of been like very hittable sinker despite, good velocity and good size, but he's a low Scott guy. He's tall. Maybe, they have him throw his 4-seamer more. It looks interesting. Maybe they have something in mind for him. Maybe he's on the team a week, but they claimed Yoenis Gomez. They're clearly kind of just grasping at relief. The starter that really scared, like long-term you'd think bullpen wise, like they have with him and Gonzalez, they have, some other options, but between the injuries they had in spring and now like Iriarte on like the ACL, Gonzalez moved to the bullpen, the AA guys not really looking like any of them are going to be, starter, forced their way into that picture this year in any way. You almost think like there's more confidence in being able to find guys like this or asking teams like the Astros, like, hey, can we buy your best AAA reliever that you're not using? More like lucking their way into confidence with that than figuring out like what they really do. One with like fifth starter slot right now, if Bryce Wilson doesn't perform better, but also just, God forbid anything happens where they actually need depth. That's what I think is a bigger question. Whereas throwing stuff at the wall of the bullpen, it's what a lot of teams do, and maybe can show a little bit of their ability to develop guys or tweak guys on the fly in these coming weeks, hopefully. But they've kind of got too many openers and not enough to throw at the back end of games, and they're responding to it.
We got plans for the first 5 innings. The last 3, we'll see. That makes it exciting watching the White Sox.
It's kind of like, well, we got an opener, and hey, one time we did it, Cannon almost threw a complete game. Maybe that's what will happen this time. And you'd like to not have to count on that.
And then, Jim, the White Sox claim Vinny Capra from the Milwaukee Brewers. Capra in 44 career Major League games, batting a whopping 105 with a 170 on base percentage and slugging 163. I know this slash line, Jim. This reminds me a lot of Jacob Amaya. So if the White Sox already have Jacob Amaya at home, why claim Capra?
I don't know.
James, do you know?
It's like he strikes me as like a Danny Mendick type in terms of I saw him a little bit in Nashville when he was the AAA Brewers team last year. And kind of a similar profile, kind of a little guy, 5'8", 20th round draft pick, like Danny Mendick was in the 20th, well, he's later, but in the 20s, and just kind of performs a triple A. But like, unlike Mendick, he hasn't had that moment of just streaks of major league competence that allow him to keep getting chances. Like, I don't quite get, at triple A, like, credible strike zone judgment. He covers all the infield positions well enough. Like, he's leading at shortstop this year in terms of where he's playing. So, certainly like a Josh Rojas type infield coverage, but with more shortstop. So, like, that's, I think, what's leading his profile right now. But in terms of why the White Sox would be interested in him at this particular time when, like, the major league results haven't been there, like, not quite sure. There's always a chance, like, as with, Danny Mendick, to where, like, he might. There might be 3 good months of major league play in him, in a reserve role, to where like it all clicks and he's finally figured it out. But for the time being, like, nothing is jumping out to me in terms of what I've seen from him in person, from what I remember, and then also just like what he's done since.
This doesn't spell good news for Amaya, does it, James? Because I can't imagine you're keeping both Capra and Amaya on the 26-man roster.
No. Unless you're like optioning Baldwin, and since Baldwin's playing so much outfield because you got three outfielders hurt, I don't think that's the case. And the role that Bill Venables described sounded a lot like Jake Amaya's job. And maybe with Rojas now back, they feel a little bit
Hey, Rojas is a left fielder.
Rojas is a left fielder, but maybe they feel a slightly bit more covered as far as like what they're going to do as shortstop, if they don't. But I still think Amaya is, like, if not head and shoulders above, a clear grade above defensively at shortstop. Like, obviously, he's like very, very close to not getting any hits all year. Like, they mentioned Capra's bat, and I think they don't do this move, but they don't think Capra can perform a bit better than Amaya offensively. How much you can really expect that based off his numbers, I don't know, but. They have to like it a touch better, but if you have Rojas in place and they're kind of leading with Meidroff mostly being the starting shortstop at this point, maybe you feel like you've graded out or graduated out a little bit from having this like defense only player. If you're maybe you're one of your prime defensive alignments involves Vargas playing third and Meidroff already short, and you have Rojas, and having kind of switching like, hey, can we get our utility man to like get a hit ever? Tilts and Miller's advantage. Also, former Brewer, obviously have the McKinnon connection to some bit. He
Right.
hasn't been up in the majors really to like vouch for him, but at least there's some familiarity where they feel like there's something that can get more out of profile. But he's outperformed Amaya a little bit in AAA, I would say. I think the idea that Amaya would hit enough to be a regular kind of dissipated at double A when he left the double A level, whereas Capra's a little bit more quad A feel to it, but yeah, it feels like a very marginal move, and things have gone about as bad as you could expect for Amaya offensively, probably a little worse, and they're really hoping he would make more contact this year. That said, like, guy did what he asked, was asked. He was a really good defender at short, so I think it's really marginal what you squeeze out of this position by making this move, but I guess they feel like they have two shortstops already, and they can have Capper move around and hopefully get some hits.
Yeah, this end of the season spore call, these are two guys that I'm probably not going to remember. Just thinking about it now. Miguel Castro, Vinny Capra, welcome to the 2025 White Sox. And as they join the White Sox again coming back home to Chicago to face the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field. This is the first of two Crosstown Classic series. The Chicago Cubs, 25-19 on the season, their first place in the National League Central, only a game ahead of the red-hot St. Louis Cardinals. The Cubs lost their last game against the Miami Marlins. The Cubs have this really weird thing where they're very good in the opening game of a series and very good in the middle game of a three-game series, and then for some reason, not great at all in the third game, failing to sweep a lot of opponents that they probably should be. So that's why they lost their last game. Just something, a weird stat that's happening to the Cubs to start the year. Last 10 games, though, the Cubs are just 4-6. And at home at Wrigley, they're just 12-10. Offensively, when you look at team OPS, the Chicago Cubs rank fourth in team OPS at 763. However, at Wrigley Field, the Cubs as a team have an OPS of 714. That's a pretty dramatic drop off for the Cubs from playing at Wrigley, hitter friendly, can be especially hitter friendly depending on the wind and Mother Nature, and then compared to on the road. Starter wise, the Cubs are doing well, even though they lost Justin Steele for the season. Their starter ERA is 3.66. That's eighth in Major League Baseball. The bullpen is an issue. The bullpen will need to be addressed before the trade deadline. It is currently their Achilles heel. The bullpen has a ERA of 4.59. That is 22nd in Major League Baseball. Your pitching problems for this series. All games are at 1:10 p.m. Central Time, because God forbid should the White Sox and Cubs ever play a night game on the weekend on the north side. All those rowdy White Sox fans coming up from the south side. Can't have them out in Wrigleyville at night. Can't do it. Whatever. Shane Smith is going to get the ball for the White Sox against Cade Horton, the promising Cubs rookie making his first start in the majors. Sean Burke will get the ball for the White Sox on Saturday against Matthew Boyd. And on Sunday, it is Jonathan Cannon against Colin Ray. So we talked about the White Sox pitching in depth in this episode and how well they did in Cincinnati. Even though there is a bit of a concern that this is mostly smoke and mirrors, the stuff has been lacking for the White Sox, but they are still getting good results. Jim, this Cubs offense, even though they're not hitting all that great at home, but if they flip a switch and they hit as well as they do on the road, this is a top five offense in Major League Baseball when it comes to OPS. And I feel like this is a good test for the White Sox starters to see how they hold up against one of the best lineups in baseball.
Yeah, especially since, you know, looking at the Cubs going into the season, you know, I was a little bit, I guess, bearish on their offense. Like, Kyle Tucker is a great addition. But just like, I didn't necessarily see Pete Armstrong doing what he's doing to this extent.
No, I didn't.
Michael Bush didn't know, like, if he would be able to sustain it. Carson Kelly coming out of, you know, really, I like the signing. I just didn't expect him to be like such an offense first catching signing the way he's been, to where, you know, all of a sudden, like, he's, you know, playing like an MVP candidate right now through the first month and a half. So yeah, I mean, like, it's a lot deeper of an offense when you look at, like, basically, you know, how they're hitting. Only two players below average offensively. So, you know, they're running seven deep as a lineup, and one of the guys who isn't hitting is Nico Horner, who's a great defender. So, like, he's, you know, no matter what, he's carrying his weight of, like, he's the worst infielder, or, like, you know, one of the worst hitters you have. Like, you're in pretty good shape. So I'm be curious to see, like, when it comes to, like, Shane Smith, it's a great test for him. Also, like, curious to see, based on what we learned from Mike Tauchman when the White Sox signed him, and just how much he changed his hitting profile. Like, I'm curious, not having watched many Cubs games, what it looks like with the wind profile, just being more keen to exactly how that plays. And, you know, it's looking at the park factors last year for Wrigley and seeing, like, how severely it was a pitcher's park last year because of just how the wind was always blowing in the wrong direction. I'm looking forward to see how that plays, because if it, you know, if the White Sox get lucky over the course of a weekend, like, it might not be so perilous for them. It's more a matter of just stringing together the good at bats, which we just talked about with the Theis, Mydroth, Caro part of the lineup. So yeah, it's going to be, I'm going to be interested to watch this Cubs team, because, you know, last year I thought they were just kind of boring that they, you know, didn't go for it. The bullpen was bad. And so just like, yeah, it always falls apart. Like, why would you be invested in this team that seems like it's kind of flatlining? But I think the Tucker addition has been exactly what they needed. The Kelly thing, signing, while it wasn't necessarily what they maybe thought he was going to be, like, credible major league catcher, sure, great, go for it. And then they're getting a lot of that, you know, Matthew Boyd, Colin Ray of the pitchers that we thought the White Sox, the tier of pitching we thought the White Sox might shop in, the Cubs went in on, and are getting fantastic results so far. So I'm curious to see, you know, watch it over three games, like, how it all works.
James, we have seen openers when the White Sox know they're going to be facing a tough left-handed hitter in the first inning. Kyle Tucker is a tough left-handed hitter. Are you foreseeing any openers for the White Sox this weekend against the Cubs?
Also, Michael Bush and Pico Armstrong and Moises Ballesteros hits left-handed too, while we're at it. Probably not Friday, given, you know, the guy with the Shane Smith has not needed the assistance, and the White Sox have not offered it. But after that, sure, I hope so. That would probably be a good idea.
lots of lefties.
Like Sean Burke has certainly benefited from it, and certainly just struggled in first innings in general, kind of getting set in a way that's, you know, prompted the time old, like, I've treated my bullpen like the first inning type of mindset adjustments to just shake out whatever bad juju feelings he's having in that. So, I think that'd be prudent with both. They, even if they option one, they have three or four. Who cares? They have a lot enough people to do it. I'd be shocked if they didn't do at least one.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of expecting that. Jonathan Cannon started an opener, even though it'd be probably a good idea.
The other thing that's funny about the Cubs looking at their player page, and something like I'm that following the White Sox will warp you, is when I go to the 2025 White Sox baseball reference page, I'm used to like scrolling a lot to get to their pitchers because of how many position players the White Sox have gone through. The Cubs, only 16 position players have taken one plate appearance for them in 2025. And like one of them is Gage Workman, who's no longer there. He's no longer on the White Sox, for that matter as well. But like the White Sox, Vinny Capra will make 24.
What?
So, yeah, they've used 50% more position players at the plate than the Cubs have. So just like the stability for one team and the utter chaos on the other, I think is just
something to be bomb this oracle. I am going to absolutely bomb. You know what? Ted's listening to this. If he's like, you know what, let's just do a sporkle now. A pop quiz. Everyone that's played.
All-star break
I'd be praying for 80%. We're not even game 50. And I'm be like, please get to 80%. Unbelievable.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it is broke, do something.
They are doing something. And to the Cubs' credit, one guy I'll be interested in watching this weekend is Pico Armstrong. This is the development win for the Cubs and even for Pico Armstrong himself, because coming through high school, there was a lot of questions about the bat and the offensive potential. He's already got 11 home runs. Pico Armstrong is currently fifth in WAR on Fangraphs in all of Major League Baseball. He's worth 2.5 WAR already this year. Nobody on the White Sox, I don't think, position player wise, is going to reach 2.5 WAR on Fangraphs this season. So, Pico Armstrong having a phenomenal start to the year. Let's see if he stays healthy and he's able to maintain it. That walk rate's below 5%, so he is up there hacking. Terrific start for PCA to start the year for the Cubs. They may have found their everyday center fielder, which, for whatever reason, money has become an issue for the Cubs. And not only do they have the Kyle Tucker question, but now they're trying to extend PCA, and we'll see if they're able to do that this upcoming offseason. But from a White Sox perspective, someone that I'm circling and kind of need to see more of is Luis Robert Jr., only because we are getting to the point of the season, Jim, that if Luis Robert doesn't turn it on, whatever asking price that Chris Getz had, I mean, he's going to have to really come down, right? Because there's some rumors that the Mets are kicking the tires for Luis Robert, but it's a weird contract situation. Very cheap buyout. It's like $2 million to buy out, but it's a $20 million option. And I'm sorry, Luis, you're playing at a level that you don't merit $20 million in 2026. So what Chris Getz could be asking for, in a Luis Robert trade, hoping to continue with his rebuild and continue adding premium prospects to the pipeline. I can't foresee any team willing to pay for that right now, because if they got Robert, Jim, and he's still the same player, he plays really good defense in center, and when he gets on base, he's running wild and he can help us out with the stolen bases. But no, he is not. He's not the 2021 version. Or maybe he is the 2021 version. Sorry, he's not the 2023 version. He's not going to hit 40 homers for us. And if we take him in, if he doesn't get better in the second half, we're buying him out for $2 million. So I feel like this weekend would be a good time for Robert, who's had big moments at Wrigley Field, to use as a jumping point to really get back on track. Because it's worrisome for me, Jim, to see that Robert is still batting below 200 at this point of the season.
Yeah, you're getting into sad trade territory, which I think like the Eloy Jimenez trade qualified as last year, of just the Orioles taking him because, hey, he was a top five prospect, and we could use him to fill that void. But also, White Sox are going to kick in $4 million because he's not worth what he's being paid, even though like he was supposed to be on like the bargain portion of his contract. And then it comes to the point where like, we want some help paying the buyout that we're probably going to give him because this is just not fun. So like, that's kind of where Robert is. I think like Robert, based on his base running and his defense, is like, there's more reason for a team to want to acquire him, even if he is like batting ninth for the Phillies or something like that, or batting ninth for the Mets, just because of his ability to play center field. Like, I think there's enough value for a team acquiring him that really needs help in the outfield that they could defend very easily the idea of trading for Luis Robert. Whereas with like Eloy, it's just a case of like, yeah, I don't know, Trey Mungo, here you go. Like just a guy who's going to be Rule 5 eligible, and we don't have any 40-man intentions for him. Sure, like I think the price will be a bit higher, but among the prospects that like either who is thoroughly blocked or is reaching a point like kind of Miguel Vargas territory of just, we're running out of time to do something with this player. The White Sox, you have more time to do something with him. Hope you're excited by Miguel Vargas. And you know, Miguel Vargas, to his credit, looking a lot better this year than he was last year. Maybe that kind of deal isn't written off so easily. It's just not going to be the franchise altering it's not gonna be like a rocket pack for the rebuild. I think when you're looking at now, just more along the lines of like trading a useful player for a useful player.
And it's shocking, really, because that was not the plan. We were thinking that when the White Sox trade Luis Robert, they can hopefully get some impact players. James, you do some prospect writing. If you were an opposing GM, is anyone offering, when you use like the future value grade, which if you go on Fangraphs.com and you look up the prospects and you look at their prospect ratings, it's the FV column. Are you giving up multiple 45 future value grade prospects for Luis Robert right now?
Multiple? No. I think you're probably, I mean, at least from like the winter, you're trying to convince them a 45 as a 50 and seeing if they agree, and then giving them some 40s with either a shot to be more or safe security around it. I think you're trying to get one regular out of Robert. I think at this point, I think it's just realistic. Like if he had started out gangbusters and had a 950 OPS, but we're at the point, a decent enough point in the season where I think even a big resurgence would be like getting him up to just healthily above average offense. And you know, he's been good on the things that are less fickle in terms of like running and showing like what he can do physically. And I think his defense has been pretty good, even if it's not going to, you know, win a gold glove probably again, the way he's tracking. But yeah, I think you've got too long of a window of him looking like an inconsistent, hard to pin down, hard to really project hitter. And I think the tools are there for a big breakout. I was talking to someone today, like, the difference between 2023 Robert and 2025 Robert right now is just crushing the stake pitches. If anything, you'd think 2025 Robert would be better because he's drawing walks in a way that, and really being active in the bases a way that like 2023 guy wasn't. But if the 2025 Robert was crushing pitches like the 2023 guy would, he'd probably stop messing around with his walk business in short order. And
Yeah.
so, yeah, I mean, elite players do that really consistently, and he hasn't done that very consistently, even if he kind of goes on a run. So I think that checker is what you can really project him at. Like, this, for all his tools, this is just not someone who's been super consistent as far as executing his strengths. Some of that's health, some of that might be other reasons, but I think it is what it is. Hope he plays well. Hope he get a regular, but probably not getting two.
If this keeps up, just the way that this season is working out, like there are some positives for Chris Getz, but I would love to get his thoughts and like the GM meetings in November. Chris, talk to me, man. What happened with Luis Robert? What happened with Colson Montgomery? You had big plans for both of these guys, hoping that it would spark the turnaround for this franchise. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. Are you now forced to search elsewhere?
I mean,
Did you find other answers elsewhere that you weren't expecting?
if you're going to ask some of that, like, seriously, not that I've, like, recently asked him about the specific thing, but his general view is, like, it's not going to hinge around, like, four or five, like, things hitting. We just kind of have to, like, and I think this would get eye rolls when he says it, because he's obviously made what look like bad decisions. But he's like, if we just keep making sound decisions consistently, like, it'll turn around. Like, our process used to be bad and now it's coherent. And if we follow along, like, our hit rate's not going to be 100%. And yeah, they wish you were getting more out of these specific dudes. But like, if our rebuild was going to hinge around like the Luis Robert trade, like being nailed, like we're already doomed. Like, we can't be like the last group where it's just like, all right, we got like these five shots at the apple and we have to nail all these trades. And otherwise, there's no cavalry ever coming behind them, or there's not really the ability to pivot or keep building up the talent base if they don't work out. I think they're going to need to draft well. I think they're going to need their international operation to click. Like, the trades grabbed a lot of attention because it's like the only way to seemingly not see this just take forever. But
Yeah.
yeah, like, if it's the fate of the franchises and Luis Robert, we've already decided that that was not going to be what carried the glory. So it can't be the thing now that Luis Robert just saves and papers over everything. Like, that's been something that hasn't been really working well for a year plus. It should be surprising it's working the same way the trade market.
Well, on a positive, the Gerrit Crochet trade, for everyone involved, that's looking pretty good. Brady Montgomery is looking really good this year. They're already getting some positive results out of Chase Mydroth. Kyle Teal will eventually join the majors. The White Sox may have gotten three major league players out of Gerrit Crochet, and Crochet is absolutely dealing for the Boston Red Sox this season. And hey, Chris, if it doesn't work out, just like your predecessor, maybe you can have some appearances on MLB Network and tell the world why it all went to hell for the Chicago White Sox when you were the GM. Great TV appearance, Rick Hahn. I wonder if he will continue appearing on MLB Network and providing his expertise of what it's like to work in a Major League Baseball front office and analyze the big moves, especially when transactions really pick up in the month of July. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, it's a pretty quick turnaround for the White Sox as the first pitch is at 1:10 p.m. Central Time at Wrigley Field. We'll have all the coverage this weekend on SoxMachine.com. I'll be hosting that watch party at the Rimowa Theater. Look forward to see many of you there to watch the White Sox and Cubs on Saturday. You can subscribe to the Sox Machine Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms. At Sox Machine, you can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website and the ability to comment on posts. We also have additional tiers of support, including some spots open in our Veterans Committee if you'd like to join our VC. Again, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.